gun to my head, when you said 2000s Grinch song, Bare Naked Ladies was my first guess for who was performing it.
And yep, I got to tell you, though, even as somebody who was an obsessive Ben Folds fan in my teens, I could not name the Christmas song that he wrote for this movie.
I can name Ben Folds' Day After Christmas song. I know that one really well. I can't recall his Christmas Day song, but the one that immediately follows, I've heard a number of times.
In 2022, two writers came together to finish what Universal Studios couldn't. A cinematic universe of monster movies called The Dark Universe. After 3 years and 30 scripts, their project was finally completed. Now, in 2025, they're back to attempt what's never been done before. A completely original cinematic universe entirely in podcast form. I'm Dalton DeShane.
And I'm Dylan Roth.
And you are now entering the Pod Universe.
Welcome to the Pod Universe, the podcast where we attempt to create an all-original sci-fi cinematic universe, one pitch at a time. I'm your mean host, Dylan Roth.
And I'm your, ooh, what are the other lyrics? What they call him Stinky, right?
I think he stink, stank, stunk, for
stink,
sure.
Stink, stank, stunk. Okay, I'm your stink, stank, stunk host, Dalton DeShane, for sure.
Yeah, together we have been
That's why I'm in the podcast medium. Well, I mean, most mediums are not smell-o-vision
yet. Are not smell-o-vision, right? Yeah, not yet. That's actually one thing the tech bros have spared us so far in the whole metaverse experiment, is that no one seems to be trying to make smell-o-vision or smell-based virtual reality a thing yet.
Do you think smells are easier or harder than legs in the metaverse?
I mean, legs apparently are the holy grail, right?
Yeah,
you would
legs,
think it was easy, but this is like, you know, the way you think it would be easy to make a robot walk or jump. You can't do that. It's just,
I think we'll get smell-o-vision before AGI. I'll tell you that much. I'm putting that down right now. Marker for 2026. In 2026, we will not get AGI. We will get digital smell-o-vision.
Okay. Well, you know, you maybe should place a bet on that. I'm one of those insane apps that's legal now, or you can bet on war crimes.
Yeah, Kalshi will probably let me bet on smell-o-vision.
Well, in between our own scripted episodes where we are adding chapters into our now four film long cinematic universe so far.
I think we're only three in.
Only three in. The next one will be number four.
Yeah.
We invite our favorite storytellers to join us in the studio or over Zoom and plumb the depths of classic genre cinema to pitch their own remakes to our imaginary studio.
That's right.
Now, we're doing a little bit of a throwback for this episode, because here we are going to be returning to the Dark Universe, folks. Our guest has brought in a pitch that is specifically tailor-made for our previous experiment, where we picked up the Dark Universe, where it left off at the end of 2017's The Mummy, starring Tom Cruise, and then wrote the next 29 movies in that saga.
You think we were done with the Universal catalog? No, there's tons more hay to make out.
That's
in there,
right.
You know?
And who will be bailing that hay out to us? Our guest this week is an Emmy-nominated TV writer and author, known for his work on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert and the reboot of Clone High, and children's books like Princess Dinosaur and Santa's Husband with illustrator Ashley Quach. His contributions to comics like Loki, Black Panther vs. Deadpool, and The Darkhold Blade. He's a writer and co-executive producer on the upcoming Netflix animated series Strip Law, and his newest book, So You've Been Bitten by a Radioactive Spider, How to Survive the Marvel Universe, is out now. Longtime listeners to Dylan and Dalton will also remember him as the creator of our Dark Universe version of Peyton Westlake, a.k.a. Dark Girl.
That's
Please
right.
Welcome to the Pod Universe, Daniel Kibblesmith.
Our claps don't pick up on mic here. They're very directional.
Yes. We do have a studio audience, but we fail to mic them.
Yeah.
Or put a camera on them.
Once we get to the 1,000 or the 10,000 a month tier on Patreon, we'll mic the audience.
Yes.
But, yeah, it's gonna be a lot easier.
And then we'll fly you out too. We'll fly you out to the studio.
That's
every
true.
Time
oh, yeah.
We have you on.
Yeah. Green room, tuxedo. Yeah, the whole bit, of course.
Oh, well, we definitely need a green room for you today.
Ooh. I love that. That's excellent foreshadowing.
Hint at what you might be pitching. But before we get to what you're going to pitch, do you know about what Dark Girl has become in the Dark Universe?
No. I have not fully kept up, which is one of the reasons that I pitched a return to the Dark Universe, is that the tale has grown in the telling in the meantime, as J.R.R. Tolkien says. So please update me.
You work in comics. You know how it is.
It's hard
to keep up.
Your character, your take on Peyton Westlake, became one of the leads of our Mystery Men. She's actually kind of the viewpoint character of the movie, as she's the person who joins the gang during the first act of the film, and joins a motley crew of other characters from across our universe to try and take down a god who has
Osiris
shacked up in Buckingham Palace. And it is a...
And I believe at one point she does print a face of Dua Lipa.
Yes.
Is that right?
She does disguise herself as Dua Lipa.
Oh, I like that. That's a great cameo.
If you're interested, the episode Mystery Men is on the Are You Afraid of the Dark Universe feed. And hopefully you like it. And if not, there's nothing you can do about it. So
I'd be very surprised if, given how... that I'm sitting in this chair right now, I'd be shocked if I was like, this one is bad. I don't like this one.
I am realizing now that when you say that it's a movie, action movie in Buckingham Palace with a guest role from Dua Lipa, it does sound like you're describing a Matthew Vaughn movie specifically.
Yes, this is Argyle 2.
Yeah, it does sound like you made Argyle 2, but it was not that.
That's what we're going to do in our next version of the podcast, where we just pick up a bunch of like Mark Miller adjacent projects and can put them all into a new universe. And we try to make it even edgier.
No. We're doing the non-fascist Mark Miller universe.
Okay. Sorry,
Daniel, you work in comics. We can't be saying these things with you on the line. We don't want
to. Oh, no. I'm aware that there's fascism in comics.
Yeah. Okay,
I've come across that phenomenon.
You've come across the theory of superheroes and fascism. Interesting.
All right, Daniel, what have you brought in for us today?
Well, much like my last appearance, I jumped on a character where I could not believe that they qualified for a Universal Dark Universe reboot.
Yeah.
I live in Los Angeles, City of Angels, City of Dreams. And I am frequently driving to Burbank for work and diner reasons. Mm-hmm. And on the way there, you pass the big billboard for Universal Studios, which is currently, this being December of 2025, currently has a great big picture of the Jim Carrey, Ron Howard, the Grinch character.
Right.
That iteration of the Grinch. And it did not occur to me until seeing that billboard that makes the Grinch a universal monster.
Absolutely. The parallels don't stop there, because the Grinch, first of all, starts out as a literary character,
mm-hmm.
similar to Dracula, Frankenstein, the Invisible Man. Then we get an adaptation starring Boris Karloff.
Connection. That's astonishing. I did not make that connection.
I had forgotten about that.
We have a Boris Karloff adaptation first. Then you get your modern late 90s, early 2000s remake that proves, for some reason, immensely formative to our generation.
So this would sort of be the Coppola or the Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.
Exactly.
Or the Brendan Fraser Mummy. Yes, absolutely.
And then you get the Hotel Transylvania-ification of it with the 2016 Illumination version.
Right.
That's right. With Cumberbatch doing an American accent. I would have used his real voice.
I have not seen the 2016
Illumination. I have seen that
one.
Okay, so we're on even terms here. And that I saw that recently with my niece, I think last Christmas. It's fine.
Illumination does good work,
yeah,
I think.
It's clever. It does things that don't feel like they're a carbon copy. Like, we're always talking about when you're going to adapt something, you got to add something. You got to do something, something new. And like, this is very much like a Minions style thing. That's like who it's for is kids who like the Minions, right?
I'm a Minions defender. I like the Minions.
And I'll say nothing about it.
I'm on record. I'm on record.
Listen, at some point, I'll get Minions pilled. I have a 3-year-old. That's going to happen.
Your 3-year-old doesn't like movies,
though. I know.
Though.
I should be so lucky that he'll want to watch a movie that I hate, because it'll just mean that he has an interest in a movie.
Daniel, how do you feel about the Minions? We need you on record.
They're fine. They're fine. You know what? Well, they're not for me. Like, if I had a strong opinion about the Minions, that's a poem that I wrote. A strong opinion about the Minions, I think it would, you know, it would seem fake. I would seem like I'm at the, you know, the lunch table trying to be cool. Like, I don't think about the Minions at all.
I don't have to think about the Minions very often, and I dread that I will likely have to think about the Minions. Maybe I'll discover that I like them a lot. Like, there are things where I thought I would...
Have you seen the videos of the voice actors, the Italian women, who do the voices for the Minions?
No, I haven't, but you had me at Italian women.
That
sounds like a fun reality show, honestly.
There's on YouTube, I thought the Minions voices were maybe computer generated or altered in some way. No, it is these two Italian women who just sound like that. And there are videos of them in the booth doing all that. Blah, 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 and it's fascinating to watch.
I am a banana cipollata. Blue says, you want me stand, le capitan, blah, 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 blah.
That sounds really fun to watch. It's like when you watch the footage of them doing the Chili's baby back ribs theme.
Yes.
And it's just like, no, this is people at the peak of their craft having an incredible time.
Exactly. And getting paid for it.
Yes. Like, I'm so like watching that. If I'm in a bad mood, I will find on YouTube the video of them recording the Chili's baby back ribs jingle.
This is extremely specific.
And it will fucking cheer me up because there is so much joy in it.
It's barbecue sauce.
Exactly.
South.
We so all maybe need that's our coping mechanisms right now.
Out of watching the Italian women in question perform as the Minions, right?
Yeah, it's great.
I went down a little rabbit hole because I know at one point some of the Minions were also voiced by one of the directors, the astonishingly named Pierre Coffin.
Oh, yes.
So
I thought that was a dark universe.
Appropriate to it. Yeah, appropriate to a dark universe podcast.
French Canadian stoner Pierre Coffin.
Yeah, if you don't have a director in mind for your Grinch remake, maybe Pierre Coffin will be a good fit.
Yeah, step on up.
Now, the thing about the Grinch as a universal monster is that it makes immediate sense on a sort of thematic level as well, because we're dealing with like a figure in isolation who is a loner, but is capable of being, if accepted, right? Or if willing to accept love, is sort of sympathetic. In a way, right? When you reflect back on the entire story, you realize, you know, this guy's all not all that bad.
To a degree that, well, we'll talk about the 2000 Grinch. I'm gonna have some words about the 2000 Grinch. But before we get to there,
I'm so glad I forgot to rewatch it.
This was my first time.
I didn't bother. Yeah, I didn't watch I haven't seen the Ron Howard Grinch. That really radiates like the, you know, you had to be.
Oh,
there.
You haven't seen it at all.
Cursed fucking vibe.
That brings us to. Daniel, what is your history with the Grinch?
So I love Christmas. I mean, some of the books that you guys mentioned are Christmas books. I gravitate towards
Hollywood.
Yeah,
you're a published Christmas author.
I'm a published Christmas author. I gravitate towards holiday stuff. And once you've done some of it, then it kind of becomes a chicken and the egg thing. So I think the last holiday thing that I wrote was probably the Kitty Pride and the X-Men Hanukkah story in last year's Marvel Holiday Tales to Astonish. And before that, I was working on a book of Harley Quinn and DC Comics themed Christmas carols that's still available. Obviously, I wrote the book Santa's Husband about Santa and his husband who also looks like a Santa. So I grew up with a Jewish mom and like Hanukkah stuff around, but we always celebrated Christmas. And for me, I don't know if it's just that I really, really hated school, but as soon as Christmas break rolled around, I just really, really felt at home. And so much of it, we were such a TV household and such an animation household and such a like collect everything on VHS household, like really making a game and a hobby out of taping things, that a lot of my childhood was centered around television and recording things off the television. And Christmas specials was like, you know, the Christmas of that, you know, the Olympics of that, the Super Bowl of that. It's like, now it's time to watch all the special television and try to record it and organize it. So the Peanuts special, you know, I've probably seen the most of any of them. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing Grinch maybe number two, Garfield number three. I love them. And you know, I'll put them on for my I have a 4-year-old and she sort of like half cares. but I also think it's because media doesn't arrive with the sort of like imports and scarcity that gave it so much importance to me when I was her age, or I was just a big dork. So I love this special. I would watch, you know, quasi-related sort of TV specials growing up where they were like, here are the voices behind, you know, a bunch of cereal mascots, which is how I learned that the guy who did Tony the Tiger is the singing voice for Boris mm-hmm. Karloff in The Grinch. And I'm a huge Chuck Jones guy. I think absolutely. Between, you know, having Dr. Seuss books read to me and then finding out like, oh my God, there's an animated version of this and it looks like Tom and Jerry and it's like really good. And the music is incredible. I love this special. And then when the live action one came out, you know, obviously I loved Jim Carrey as a young person, but I was getting older and this seems to be skewing younger and, you know, it didn't really appear to be for me. So I just sort of wrote it off.
Yeah. I mean, very safe move. so it is to date the OG Boris Karloff. That's the only adaptation you've seen of The Grinch.
I've seen the Benedict Cumberbatch one as well.
Oh, you have seen that one.
I've seen the more recent one. I think it's pretty good. I think it's hard to turn these stories into feature length movies.
Yeah.
And I also think that movies, especially movies for little kids, demand a bit of like, you know, maybe this is the studio it came out of, or maybe this is just an easy trap to fall into, but a bit of overcranked Save the Cat where he is kind of not allowed to be grinchy for the whole movie.
Yeah.
He does a lot of sort of like gently, you know, heroic. The needle they're sort of threading is like, well, the Grinch always had a dog, so maybe he loves animals.
Mm.
But you know, that's also true of sociopaths. So,
I find like there's a difficulty that I have right now with children's movies that were probably that's probably the case when I was a kid too. I just wasn't noticing or thinking about them. Is that there's like a clock, like a ticking clock at all times in the movie. Like, okay, when are we going to do a big needle drop or dance party? You have to have a dance party like every 12 minutes. There must be a dance party, and bonus points if it's to a song the parents already know.
Yeah.
And I find that challenging.
It's hard.
I'm sold on this movie because I really didn't know much about it, but I am looking at the Wikipedia right now, and it does say that Danny Elfman and Tyler, the Creator, collaborated on a new version of You're a Mean One, Mr. Grinch.
Yeah, I like that track, okay.
I gotta hear that. I'm Danny and Tyler?
I've seen this movie. I have no memory of this.
I mean, it could be like, you know, the 2001, you know, they had... The first thing I'm going to say about the 2000, because I did just watch it for the first time, because I was like...
Poor thing.
Prior to this week, I had only ever seen the original Boris Karloff, which I haven't seen in a long time, but I watched it a bunch as a kid and I loved it. And I was like, well, we're talking about The Grinch. I should watch like, because also, oh my God, at Thanksgiving this year, my cousin, we were talking about Christmas movies and he said the words to me, the Jim Carrey Grinch is the best one. And I said,
okay, that's very specific.
I said, what are you talking about? Like, I hadn't even seen it, and I knew that wasn't true. I was like, what about the original? He's like, no, that one's got Jim Carrey in it. And I was like, this can't be true. So I was like, I have to watch this. We're talking to Daniel about it. I haven't seen it. I'm not going to know what I'm talking about. And my cousin says it's the best one. First of all, I hate a movie that is only enough of a musical to justify selling a soundtrack album. It will not commit to being a musical, but it will have enough songs that you can be like, that you can release that. Yeah. That. But
it's also a Christmas soundtrack. I mean, they're printing money. If they, you
exactly.
know, it's still the compact disc era. Here's like yet another Christmas album that you can add to the collection within the collection.
And they commissioned a bunch of original songs from people like Bare Naked Ladies and Ben Folds. Mm-hmm. And
gun to my head, when you said 2000s Grinch song, Bare Naked Ladies was my first guess for who was performing it.
And yep, I got to tell you, though, even as somebody who was an obsessive Ben Folds fan in my teens, when you still had to like hunt down all like the rare tracks off of EPs that were released in Australia or whatever, I could not name the Christmas song that he wrote for this movie.
Yeah, it plays in the credits. I heard it. It's not very good.
Okay.
And I can name Ben Folds' Day After Christmas song. I know that one really well. I can't recall his Christmas Day song, but the one that immediately follows, I've heard a number of times.
Part of his Advent series. Yeah, he never finished it, just like Sufjan in the States Project. Yeah, you know?
That's a big finale, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
It would be weird if they just like included like a prequel to Brick on the Grinch soundtrack.
And by the way, Daniel, you said you're coming back in to pitch the prequel to Brick next time, right?
Correct. Yeah,
the movie prequel to the song Brick.
Right. It's a little confusing because there's also a movie called Brick.
Yes. Anyway, there's a Bare Naked Lady song, and it's just you hear it, a snippet of it in the background while everyone's Christmas shopping, and it's like, oh, I guess they have the Bare Naked Ladies in Whoville. But that's like, you know, they'll often commission one of these songs and then it's like barely in the movie, but you know, it gets you to stream the soundtrack or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I watched the 2000 Grinch. It is utter dog shit. It is yeah. I was furious. First of all, Dr. Seuss just shouldn't be adapted to live action. That is a fatal flaw right off the bat, because it's not just the story that's being told. It is the Dr. Seuss illustrations, which are so vibrant and joyous and energetic and awesome. And when you try to make a human look like that, it is the most hideous thing you've ever seen in your life. All the Whos are terrifying. The Grinch is terrifying. The weird like beer belly they give him is just like off-putting, not in like a body shaming way, but just like it doesn't look natural. Like it is as hard as like it looks like it's made out of wood with like hair plastered to it.
The uncanny valley can be achieved practically, and this is how we know.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm sure I haven't seen it. I'm guessing Jim Carrey makes a real meal out of wearing a big giant belly. A lot of slapping, probably.
A lot of slapping, and he's doing the weirdest voice. It's so hard to understand him. The choices he's making are out of this world, even for Jim Carrey. It is a baffling performance in a film of baffling performances. But the way that it like bulks up the story is it gives him this tragic backstory of being raised among the Whos, and then he has a crush on one of his Who classmates. But all the other kids laugh at him and say he has a hairy face. And then he tries to shave, and then they laugh at him again. And so that's why he goes out to Mount Crumpet. And you know, like, It really villainizes the Whos in a way that kind of muddles up the entire point of the story, where it's like, well, the Whos in this one are like consumerists and they're just obsessed with buying things and they don't understand what Christmas is. Mm-hmm. But the Grinch also doesn't understand what Christmas is. And the Whos are bullies to him, but then he's a bully back. And it's, I don't know, it really, I think, misses the point of the Grinch in a big way. Mm-hmm. All the jokes are just like ancient sort of vaudeville shtick, but done sort of unintelligibly in a way that doesn't land. It's just a real, real piece of shit. And I can't emphasize how terrible it is to look at. Just a really, really ugly film.
Well, you know what? It probably makes this even a little bit more painful in hindsight. Jim Carrey compared the process of wearing the makeup and costume for the Grinch to being buried alive. He once kicked a hole in the wall of his trailer in frustration at the makeup process.
Yeah.
In order to help him control his temper and to cope with the grueling makeup process, producer Brian Grazer hired a consultant to train him in methods for, quote, enduring torture, end quote.
Oh my
Carrey
God.
Spent 92 days in Grinch makeup for this film.
It took 92 days to film? I'm not in the industry, but isn't that a long time?
That sounds like a long time.
For one actor on set?
I'm guessing he's in almost the entire thing. I'm inferring that from that detail. I have to believe that if this was done, like he's done motion capture since. He's done like, he's been skinned as probably the most kind of one-for-one comparison, Ebenezer Scrooge. He's done that character since. So certainly now this would be some kind of hybrid or, you know, he would have just, I guess, been the voice because that's what they did. They made a fully animated one.
Yeah. My recollection is that the contact lenses in particular were making him go insane.
He just thought he was going to be in the Earth Girls Are Easy makeup again. He was like, oh, it's the same thing, but green. I'll just do that.
Remarkably similar. That is a great pull. Those guys look so much like Grinches.
Yes. They're from the same planet, you know? Yeah. And look, I apologize because I know this film is really formative for a lot of people. And I'm sorry. Look, you're a kid and you watch a Christmas movie and it breaks your brain a little bit because it's just part of... You're surrounded by joy at this time, maybe, and so you don't say anything about Christmas Vacation. That's a good movie. But the Grinch...
I like that one.
Yeah. Dylan
yeah,
hates.
You're from Chicago. This is a purely Midwestern disease. we never caught it out here.
So I'm sorry to the people that really love the 2000 Grinch, but I think it is an anti-Seuss film, and I love Seuss, and this feels like... They write an original song. That was like, they tried to make like a big hit.
There's an interesting story around the song you're talking about, Where Are You Christmas?
Where Are You Christmas?
Written by Mariah Carey with James Horner, the composer for the film, my freaking dude, and Will Jennings.
Mariah Carey doing another Christmas song is frankly flying too close to the sun.
Here's the thing. She did not record it because she was in the middle of a legal case with her ex-husband. And so they couldn't release her version, and Faith Hill re-recorded it for the release.
That's the version on the credits.
That's
okay.
The version that's on there. So, yeah, we could have easily ended up with another big Mariah Carey Christmas single or a disgraceful flop that would mar her otherwise pristine Christmas
legacy.
No,
the thing is about the song, I think it is a lovely Christmas song in that it is very similar to... what's the John Williams one for Home Alone? Somewhere in my memory.
Yeah.
It's very Somewhere in My Memory. It is not very Seuss-y. And so the film is constantly going through this kind of whiplash where it'll get to a part of the story that's in the book and it will quote the book directly. And so suddenly the dialogue and the narration gets very Seuss-y. It's narrated by Anthony Hopkins, by the way. And so things will get very, very Seuss-y in their cadence and everything. But then you get to a part that they have sort of extrapolated, and anything Seuss related goes out the window. There's no more rhyming dialogue. You get a song like this that doesn't even attempt to be a little Seuss-y in its language. Yeah, and then it's time for him to plan, you know, his hijinks, and suddenly we're talking in verse again. And so it's very disjointed in that way. I'm going to stop complaining about it.
No, that's right. This is just bringing me back because my exposure to this movie is I also did not see it as a kid, which is probably why I don't like it. I'm sure there's lots of movies that I saw as a kid that are bad, that I would go back and watch and be like, yeah, I am recalling the feeling of liking this movie. Like, I'm sure if I put on D2, The Mighty Ducks now, I would think it was trash.
No,
pretty good
on.
Example.
But I first saw this at my then-girlfriend's family home on Christmas, and it was so weird to be watching this with her and, like, her siblings. And they're all like aglow and with this Christmas joy.
That is such a weird experience.
And I am like
intruding on someone else's like traditions where, and you're like, I don't get it.
Well, yeah. I mean, their whole thing was that they would watch that in the morning and then they'd have the Christmas Story marathon on all afternoon.
Oh, that's
and I fucking hate that movie too. And I'm like trying to give it a fair shake because like the argument that they would make, which I think in general I still agree with, is this is kind of the way to watch that movie. It's just like an episodic thing. You just have it on, you pop in and out. It's not really a movie.
It is
watch.
A really interesting discovery. To put that on for 24 hours and figure out that it largely works in that format is like fascinating. I would love to see like seven more of those.
I mean, they did make a second one, right?
It's not
a Christmas
good.
Story.
Yeah, probably not Christmas. Literally that. More just like another movie that's like, you know, like Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, you know, where it's like Wolf and Yes, you know. Just play that for 24 hours and dipping in and out.
But it was like this weird moment where you were like, in hindsight, you can think like, it's a surefire sign it wasn't going to work out.
Yeah.
Just like that just was going to be my Christmas day for the rest of my life. I don't think so.
I always think with the sequel, because they made a sequel called A Christmas Story Christmas or something like that.
What?
And I remember.
Yes. It was on Netflix, I think. Or
it was
HBO
on Netflix,
Max.
I think. Yeah.
It's an HBO Max original that came out two Christmases ago, I think. Because I remember seeing the press releases for it because I was a critic at the time. And I kept getting these very confusing emails.
Well, so the thing was, it's called A Christmas Story Christmas, but I remember when I saw the tweet like announcing it, there was a typo where it said A Christmas Story colon Christmas.
Christmas, yes.
And I was like, that is...
That was
that's a pretty dope
one
title,
of the
actually.
Weird press
yeah. Christmas
releases.
Story yes. colon Christmas.
Yeah, I actually really like, now I'm back in. That yeah. I think is very engaging.
Fast and Furious presents A Christmas Story, colon Christmas.
All right. Well, I think that we've whipped this rain dog half to death, and we should probably move on to hearing your pitch.
Have we said enough?
About the Grinch?
About the Grinch?
I don't think anybody watching or listening to this needs a recap of the Grinch. If you do, pull it off of your bookshelf. You do have a copy. And just give it a quick read. It'll take you about 15 minutes.
Or the Boris Karloff version is like 25 minutes long.
That's true. And it is a great short film from the greatest American animation director of the 20th century, if not ever.
I really want to rewatch it this season.
Yeah.
I'm gonna rewatch it.
I'll see if Avery will sit through it. And if not, I will be getting a new child.
I will say...
when Christmas is coming. Yeah, were you good?
I'm sure you've already cast your Grinch in your upcoming adaptation, but I do just want to throw out there that in December 2024, just 1 year ago, Jim Carrey stated that he's open to reprising his role as long as it's motion capture. So he's up for the Grinch too.
Okay.
Even Grincher.
It's funny that, like, didn't he say he was going to retire? But then he came out of retirement to do one more Sonic the Hedgehog movie.
And now,
he wants to revisit one of the most unpleasant experiences of his life.
And I think we call it How the Grinch Stole Christmas, colon, Christmas.
All right. We will be right back, folks, with a pitch from Daniel Kibblesmith, who is going to give us the universal horror classics monster version of How the Grinch Stole Christmas. We'll be right back. This episode has been brought to you by mad scientist Anthony Bowman's unholy creation, The Frankencast. If you're missing Frankenstein after the conclusion of the Dark Universe, The Frankencast has been watching and discussing Frankenstein movies for over 200 episodes. Each week, mad scientist Anthony Bowman and deranged lab assistant Eric Velasquez analyze and discuss a different Franken film in conversations that range from the insightful to the absurd. Join them in the lab every Frankenstein Friday, wherever you get your podcasts. This episode is brought to you by RPG designer Jellyfish Lines and their new game, Townies. Townies is a journaling game based on the Lost and Found engine by Jack Harrison and is a love letter to Midwest Rust Belt cities and towns. This game is about how a town changes over time. It's about the town and the people in it. It's about those left behind by capitalism's chase for profit at the expense of people. Thank you in advance for checking out Townies. That's T-O-W-N-I-E and then S in parentheses. You can find it and any of Jellyfish Lines' other games at jellyfishlines.carrd.co. We now return to the Pod Universe. We are here with Daniel Kibblesmith, and we are going to hear Daniel's pitch for a Universal Monsters version of How the Grinch Stole Christmas. Daniel, how do you want to start? How do you want to dive in?
You left us with some pretty disturbing information in the break, but I don't want you to have to start there. But it did put me on edge. I'm a little frightened now of where this is going
to
go.
One thing I do have to clear the air is that this is a game time decision. I was picturing as the Grinch, who would be probably a combination of a costume and CGI. I had cast David Howard Thornton, the current portrayer of Art the Clown from the yes. Terrifier franchise. Uh-huh. However, in confirming that he was the current Art the Clown, I did discover that he played a Grinch-like character in a slasher movie called The Mean One.
Oh, he's in The Mean One.
2022.
Okay.
So he's already been
done this already.
Grinch.
That is a bummer.
Great minds, perhaps the greatest of minds, are thinking alike on this one. So it's just Doug Jones. Let's just say it's Doug Jones.
We'll do Doug Jones.
Sure.
He'd crush it. Why not?
Yeah. I assume Doug Jones is all over the Dark Universe already, but you can triple dip
on Doug
Jones.
We've actually never officially cast Doug Jones because almost every time we wanted to do it, it felt like it was too obvious of a pick.
Yeah. I think he's like, maybe our creature actor,
at least some of the
but
time.
But not officially.
Not officially. Yeah. He gets brought up in those conversations a lot. Of course, we love Doug Jones, one of the best at what he does.
Is Dick Warlock still alive?
Did a Star Trek.
I actually think he should. But yeah, Dick Warlock is still alive. He was.
I mean, the name alone is immortal.
He was one of the Michael Myerses, and I just love him because his name is Dick Warlock. He's a stuntman.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
I mean, if that's your name, you got to use it. And if it's not, and if you choose that name, you know what you're doing.
Okay, so yeah, Doug Jones, because we don't want to be making the mean one too, essentially.
Exactly. And I think mine is different enough. That seems to be a pure slasher, and you'll see that this one fits neatly into another genre.
I'm also guessing the mean one is dog shit, and I'm assuming yours isn't. So
you know, mine doesn't exist, so it's safely in the platonic ideal.
Yeah, exactly.
it's pretty good, actually. It might be the best movie ever made. buckle up, pour your hot cocoa, sit by a roaring fire, and prepare yourself for the Doug Jones vehicle, the Dark Universe Grinch. A desert landscape, dead of night. Clear back, black sky, thick with stars. A bedraggled coyote limps across the screen, trying and failing to catch a jackrabbit. The subtitles put us at December 25th, 1944. Suddenly a flash. The coyote looks up, his eyes reflecting the white light in the microsecond before the screen is consumed in white. But this white Christmas is not an unexpected snowfall. The eerie silence gives way to deafening roar as a mushroom cloud of an atomic test blossoms in the desert. The roar is sustained, anguished, and almost animal. Ash and fallout begin to flutter down, a radioactive pestilence indistinguishable from snow. Titles, The Grinch.
Okay, Daniel, you don't know this because you're not up to date on the show. Our most recent scripted episode of the Pod Universe is called Los Alamos, and it is a sci-fi movie and thriller set at the Manhattan Project.
which does mean I have to jump in with my short little well, actually, and then I'll drop it. The first atomic bomb was not detonated until July of 1945.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to correct you, but the first one that you know about.
Ah, you're right. I forgot about... I'm thinking of the Trinity test. I forgot about the Grinch test.
Exactly.
That happened the prior Christmas. Yeah.
Exactly.
They made Fat Man, Little Boy, and Jolly Saint Nick, but we never talked about
that
one.
That's right. It's like a bowl full of jelly.
All right, Daniel, go on, please.
Today, roughly 80 years later, we move to a sleepy desert town nearby, but not so nearby that it's still uninhabitable. Anyone who lives here was born here and will probably die here, some sooner than others. One motel, one diner, a gas station grocery store, and not much else. The town was built in the 40s, the last stop on the way to a mysterious military base 100 miles down the road. Officially, it's Mount Crumpet. But anyone who knows this town exists calls it by another name, Whoville, as in, who the hell would want to live there? On cue, a car pulls into town, a too clean, too new white electric vehicle. It stands out next to the dusty, rusted pickup trucks like a fake tooth. Out steps Cindy Lou, 20s. Let's suggest Chase Infinity. Is she burnt on your show?
She's in the Pod Universe, but no, she's
scene
not.
Got cut.
I cut
she was
her.
Going to
yes,
be in
perfect.
Los Alamos, but she's
all
not.
Right.
So Chase Infinity.
Oh,
yes.
This is kismet. Welcome, welcome to the universe, Chase Infinity. Cindy is a grad student. Her thesis is on the long-term effects of radiation and atomic testing, fertility rates, cancer, mutation. She's a scientist, but not a skeptic. Whoville is full of rumors and rumblings. She believes that when Oppenheimer split the atom, he opened a door in reality itself. Who knows what could have gotten through? Cindy checks into the hotel and makes her first unexpected discovery, that they lied on Yelp about having electric charging stations. The grumpy clerk behind the counter makes it clear that he thought it was the same thing as having an exterior outlet. And right now, young lady, we need those to power our Christmas lights. Only slightly deterred, Cindy settles into town for the long haul and heads into the ancient diner that serves as the center meeting place of town. The diner has all the sad plastic trappings of a desert Christmas, the same decorations that come out of the shed every Christmas since the 50s. Dogs are barking jingle bells on the radio, a cheap gag that sets the tone and also a grim foreshadow of what's to come.
Oh, no.
It's rare to get a customer under 60, especially a beautiful city girl. And Cindy Lou catches the eye of the diner's current operator, Max, roughly her age. Played by the, you're a little ahead of me. Roughly her age. played by the, I don't know if you've used him yet, the dreamy and bulky Leo Woodall.
No, I'm not familiar with Leo Woodall.
Might know from White Lotus season 2 as kind of the party fuck boy.
Hunky guy.
I've seen him. Yeah, I remember him.
He's in the new movie Nuremberg that you definitely have not seen.
Yeah, the very real movie Nuremberg.
Mm-hmm. The existence movie.
Yes.
vague army tattoos, sad eyes, the kind of movie guy who is weirdly too hot to be there and never stops wiping the counter. Cindy has Max's attention, but she barely gets a glance from the old regulars planted on their stools ever since they got back from Vietnam. Cindy explains what she's looking for in town, the rumors of something strange afoot in Mount Crumpet. Leo isn't buying what she's selling. There's nothing special about Whoville. It's probably the least special place on Earth. Max was raised here by his grandpa, took over the diner when grandpa became bedridden, and as soon as Gramps kicks the bucket, Max is getting out of here. But Cindy is cute and a breath of fresh air, and the two quickly become close. And they both clock that the other must be lonely. After all, who else would be out here 3 days before Christmas? Cindy doesn't talk to her family and has no time for Christmas on her scientific discoveries. but Max loves Christmas. He's the one who insisted on putting up the old decorations in the diner. And the next carol that comes on the radio, hey, am I allowed to sing a little bit of a real song or will you guys get in trouble?
All right, the next. You go ahead, and if there's a problem, then there will be a little. We will put something funny in place of whatever you say.
That's right. We'll put dogs barking jingle bells, but it'll be a new recording of actual dogs barking jingle bells because that will be public domain.
That's right.
So the next carol that comes on the radio is Wham's Last Christmas. He croons along badly, last Christmas, I gave you my heart, teasing Cindy and cracking her up, while the grizzled vets roll their eyes at the indignity of young love. Classic rom-com moments. That night, the Christmas lights outside the hotel are slowly pulled down. Pop, 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 pop. It rouses the grumpy clerk behind the counter, who goes out into the now darkened courtyard to investigate, where he is brutally shredded by something we only see in glimpses, something more animal than man. The next day, Cindy discovers the locals crowded around the body. The county sheriff has been called, but he's so drunk and far away as to be totally useless. Mount Crumpet is on their own. What could have done this? Coyotes? A bear? No one is sure, but it got the grizzled old vets off their stools. In a town where nothing happens, everyone is suddenly wondering, what happens next? Cindy isn't going to wait around so it can catch her off guard. She convinces Max to drive her out to the border of the testing site to take some soil and plant life samples. When they're attacked by the same beast, it pounces on Max, but then it does something unlike any animal, something with a human malevolence behind it. It stabs him in the back with a syringe, pumping him full of a glowing green liquid. Max doesn't see what happened, perhaps mistaking it for a scratch or a bite, but he turns to fight the creature off, pulling out a fistful of its fur as the beast flees on all fours. Cindy runs over to tend to him, but Max clocks that she seems more curious about the fur than Max's well-being, and she's right to be curious. It's unlike any animal fur we've ever seen, and it's as green as the glow of radium. The next, please.
Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt.
No, not at all. This is a pitch.
At this point, how much of the Grinch, like in this attack, how much of, or whatever the creature is, I'm sorry, I don't want to assume it's the Grinch. How much of this creature have we seen? Is the look at the hair like really the clearest thing we've seen? Has it been kind of just shadows and?
I treat this as, this is confirmation of what you already know. Okay. I think that in order for him to plunge a syringe in the back, you now see that this is like a fully humanoid figure with that like, classic eggplant belly that we were talking about earlier. the little split palm tree tuft of hair. But I think crucially, I don't think you see his face. I don't think you see the degree to which he does or doesn't contain a soul, you know, a humanity behind the eyes.
Okay, great.
And the green fur is, you know, that moment of rest, that moment of realization that we're paying off what we've promised on the poster.
Sure, sure. But I just wanted to clarify what we're picturing in our mind's eye right now.
The next day, Max is bandaged, but he's acting weird, irritable. Is he just upset with Cindy because of the way she reacted? His life was fine before she showed up. He's also having little seizure-like tics. She tries to ask what's wrong, but he barks at her to leave him alone. Barks being the key word. Max storms out of the diner in a strange fit of rage, as if called by some silent frequency. The old vets watch him go. This just got interesting. By night, we see Max on foot. He's gone closer to the testing site than anyone has ever been, agitated and feral, his eyes reflecting on the moonlight like the coyote in our opening. He scrambles over a barbed wire fence and looks around, sniffing and snarling. There, in the Los Alamos-esque town that's a different town.
Different and more secret.
Yes.
Different and more secret. He sees a silhouetted figure, tall and lanky like a furry emerald slender man. Max approaches the creature cautiously and then submissively gets down on his knees and lets the beast man pet his head. For the first time, we hear the Grinch speak. Good dog. The next day, Cindy finds that Max has left the diner and gets the full story from the old vets who come in regardless of whether the place is open or closed. Concerned about Max's well-being, they point her towards Max's grandpa, who Cindy finds bedridden upstairs, blind and barely alive. With his last fading breaths, Max's grandpa utters a deathbed confession that he used to work at the military base, and it was more than a nuclear testing site. It was a place of forbidden World War II era occult science, a place where they played God and used the power of the atom to open a door to a world of monsters. One day, something or someone got through. Cindy finds Grandpa's old trunks of files, looking through yellowed clippings and photographs as he continues his exposition. The creature that she saw last night with Max, strapped to a table, stabbed with needles, filled with tubes, writhing in agony, a classic misunderstood universal monster. No, does he have a soul? Sure. Can he be restored and saved? This creature was not meant for our world. Every second he's here is agony, like a shrieking noise in his ears. And the closer we get to the anniversary of his unholy arrival, the more pain he's in. Or, in the gallows humor so typical of the military, they unfeelingly summed it up thusly. He hated Christmas.
I assume now we can see that he has pained eyes.
Deeply pained eyes. Deeply pained eyes,
yes.
You could say that he feels like he's being buried alive.
Exactly. So they named him after an old Yiddish word, Grinch. The Grinch is a shadow Christ, a bizarre motherless demon born of man's hubris without the touch of God or woman. Now, this is where I tell, you know, you guys, the execs, that Grinch is obviously not a real Yiddish word.
I was about to ask, I was like, that can't be true, can it?
Absolutely not correct. But I am pulling my Jewish privilege and also the history of horror movie privilege to be completely oblivious about a real culture.
Yes, for sure. Yeah.
Which is just, you know, when you're making a horror movie, just for whatever reason, to this day, you can be like, this is how voodoo works, and then just make something up.
Well, Dylan and I neither condone nor have a problem with it. It is not ours to have an opinion on.
I'm allowed to have an opinion about it. Are you Jewish? You do not know this?
I did not know this.
My dad's family is Jewish, and my wife is Jewish, and my son is Jewish. I am, by Jewish law, not Jewish. And also, not in any practical way that matters to me, except when it means I get to approve or disapprove of something by right of being Jewish enough to do so. And Daniel, it's cool by me.
Yep. He got out his finger. Yeah, for people not watching the Zoom, he got out his big rubber stamp that makes me a sensitive person.
Yes. I'm handing out the one half of what I call a shtetl pass that I'm allowed to hand out to give people the permission to do something Jewish.
We did it.
Which, again, here,
you don't need.
Yeah.
As someone with a Jewish mother, you outrank me.
We did it. Yeah, Grinch is now officially a Yiddish word, and his roots in World War II conveniently skirts the Holocaust. All right. They restrained the creature. They tortured him. They experimented on him. Until one day, it broke free and it killed them all. The grandpa was the only one left alive. The place was fenced off, buried in paperwork and barbed wire and smokescreen. Having finally made his grand confession, Grandpa dies. Cindy now believes that this Grinch has Max and recruits the old-timer vets from the diner to become a hunting party to go find him. It's Tremors meets Predator as the ancient vets get strapped and head out into the military base where, of course, they're picked off one by one, and Cindy is captured by the Grinch and strapped to the same table where he was experimented on all those decades ago. That's when in the shadows she sees Max, now a radioactive mutant werewolf-like creature born of the Grinch's experiments with his own DNA and the local coyotes. Is there any of the original Max left in him? As the Grinch approaches with his syringe, oh, I forgot to mention, Max has a bone sticking out of his head that looks a lot like the animated Grinch's little stick antler.
One antler. I was literally about to pitch that to you. I was like, can we give him mutant antlers? And yep. I'm so glad you were ahead of me on that. Yep. I just got to let the professional do his work. Yeah.
As the Grinch approaches with his syringes, intent on transforming Cindy into another disgusting abomination, an affront to the gods and men of this world that trapped him here, Cindy pleads for Max to help her. Max snarls at her uncomprehendingly. Cindy, crying but hopeful, unleashes her Hail Mary. She sings, "Last Christmas, you gave me your heart." The Grinch covers his ears, shrieking in pain. Weird weakness, but convenience. She sings louder. Max seems to calm. He looks from Cindy to the Grinch, and in a voice more animal than man, he says, "Cindy." The Grinch, fighting through the agony, struggles towards Cindy to stab her with another syringe, but Max the Dogman leaps into action, tearing into the Grinch and giving Cindy the time she needs to escape from her restraints. She picks up every chemical syringe that she can find and stabs them all into the Grinch at once, causing spontaneous mutation overload. His organs start to grow and burst. His heart grows three sizes. His liver grows three sizes. His pituitary gland expands until his head bursts, covering both Cindy and Max in green glop. The Grinch is dead. Max nuzzles her, and she vows to use whatever evidence is left behind in the lab to cure him. But there's a sudden clatter, and Max growls, sniffing the air. They tentatively follow, discovering two more empty cages, adjacent cages about the size of chimpanzees, their rusted doors swinging open. The cages are marked with ancient yellowed adhesive labels in crisp military type. They read, "Thing One." And Thing Two.
Oh my god.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. We're Daniel, delightful. as always, you came fucking prepared.
You're setting up a whole Seussaverse.
The Dark Seussaverse.
I have a hard time imagining that the mean one could stack up against that tale here. A couple of notes. First, I think it is. I love the way that you have created a unique angle to not just do what I assume that other one is, which is why don't we just take the plot of How the Grinch Stole Christmas and try to turn it into a slashing movie as one-to-one as possible. This, again, is an assumption I am making in not terribly good faith, but I kind of assume that that's what the mean one is. I do, however, feel that I'd like there to be some kind of way for him to steal Christmas somehow in the course of this story. If not literally, then in some metaphorical way.
Does he come to town, you know, like on Christmas Eve, and then the grizzled vets go out to him, right? Like,
yeah,
there's sort of the...
There's some room here for some more second act stuff, right?
Yeah, like he comes to town and knocks over the Christmas tree in the town square and things like that. Yeah,
this is where I confess that him stealing the Christmas lights off the hotel was supposed to be like two more beats, and I just like ran out of time. Because
your instincts
are spot on. It needs that slasher pacing, you know. Even though ours isn't a slasher, it needs that slasher pacing where there's a couple more times when he comes to town and does something that as you're saying, resembles stealing Christmas. Yeah, I think that's a great idea.
Well, we can even tie it back to, like, you know, if the idea is that he's in the most pain around Christmas, when he was born, we look back and we see that during all these experiments and stuff, the army personnel had decorated for Christmas. So he also has this kind of sense memory of, like, he sees gifts and he sees the lights and he goes on a rampage because that's what he remembers. Like, in fact, maybe that's, he was tortured so badly, like, he has, like, these, you know, Vietnam flashbacks of just Christmas trees and all these things.
That's great. Because what that does is it adds a layer of thematic resonance to the vets who are coming in. That idea of, you know, also like the cycle of war and being away from your family at Christmas time and the PTSD of, you know, like the military industrial complex creating monsters, breaking the hearts of people who didn't deserve this. You're tying it together. This is good stuff.
I like also the opportunity for Cindy Lou Who to. The way that the Grinch lashes out against Christmas perhaps could resonate in something in her more specifically about Christmas. So we can add another layer onto this in another way it reflects back to our lead where she has to sort of confess that her first instinct also is kind of to pull all the lights down because she has this bad relationship with her family. Christmas is, for a lot of people who are like disconnected or have like bad blood with their family, it can be a really difficult and lonely time of year, right? So this is all almost feels as if she's externalizing her feelings through this monster. Obviously, that's not literally what's happening, but it's a way for us to reflect back on her.
Oh, I love this. It adds a layer of resentment when she shows up with the electric car that it's not just an inconvenience. It's that she's trapped here so that this thing that she kind of resents can be celebrated.
Yeah.
It's very motivated now.
She's being forced to sacrifice her freedom for this ritual, which is a way that she felt about this for years when she was still doing the habit of going back home to Christmas and then having to put up with all these little traditions that frustrate her or that force her to interact with people she doesn't want to interact with. So this is like, it's kind of just reflect right back on that. I think that's really fun. Also, if you'll indulge me, I have a sci-fi wrinkle that I think would help us to create a potentially an opportunity to open the story up a little bit, but also a literal science fiction device to further explain the annual headaches that the Grinch has. I think that whatever this dimensional rift is static in space. And so when the Earth revolves around the sun, it gets farther away from the rift, which is stuck there. And then
I'm pumping my fist in the air.
Yes, thank you. And then as this, rift remnant that exists there in the physical space gets closer to the one that exists in static space, they reverberate in a way that only someone from the other universe can hear and or can sense. And it drives them absolutely fucking mad.
And they associate that feeling with the look and sound of Christmas.
Right, because the Grinch doesn't know what's happening, right? It's going to be something that, like, something for our lead to do, right? Cindy Lou, she's a scientist. It's going to be something that she discovers, right?
Yes, that's great.
Not necessarily being a skeptic, but she wants to investigate the thing, right? And so one of the mysteries she can solve is, like, but why Christmas? Because she knows why Christmas for her, but she wouldn't know why Christmas
for the Grinch.
You need a rational explanation, right? So she finds that, and that's a cool thing. And that can also be a thing that, like, maybe we can give them another objective beyond killing the monster that they could explore, or they could tie in some way. Like, maybe it's easier to kill the Grinch when the rift is open, or maybe they need to close the rift or something like that.
Getting him back through the door, you know, is a very logical. I adore this. I love the way the Christmas lights reaction as well. It feels like so universal. It's very, you know, fire bad, right? It's very like the monster has been through something.
I also, I do have a pitch for how we make the Grinch's weakness make add all together.
Okay.
So I think I like the Last Christmas bit, but this will also save us a little money on licensing.
Always a good idea.
Always a good idea. Look, we got to save our budget where
not everybody can afford the Bare Naked Ladies.
That's right.
Yeah, we'll be getting Dalton DeShane and the Traveling Show to contribute to this soundtrack.
Yeah, we'll write all the original songs. I think while they're getting to know each other in our meet cute phase, you know, Max is trying to explain like what it is that he loves about Christmas to her. And, you know, she's like, I'm not into it. And she catches him singing this song that seems like nonsense to himself. And she's like, what is that? And he's like, well, my grandpa taught me this song. And he used to always sing it around the holidays. And I don't really know. He said it's something that like him and his army buddies just kind of made up. You know? And it's
homie.
It's a little Fahu Flores, Dahu Dores.
Yes, bring
carol.
It home. Uh-huh. Yes.
And so she learns this from him, but because he was taught it by his grandpa, they were singing it at the base around the Grinch while he was being experimented on while he's in pain. So when she comes back and she's trying to get Max to wake up, she sings Fahu Flores, Dahu Dores because that's his song and it kills the Grinch.
And I'll tell you what
hurts
else.
The Grinch because,
buys him some time before he gets kicked back through the Terran space, maybe.
Exactly.
And I'll tell you what else. This feels very much like something that either of my grandfathers would do with his army buddies. They could also have written a song to mock the Grinch in his cave. In his cage.
Yeah,
they could also have written a song to mock the Grinch in his cage, and they write, "You're a mean one, Mr. Grinch." like we could assuming we're gonna do a flashback, we can imagine like there's like one guy in the barracks or whatever who like has a guitar, or like they have an upright piano.
They're all
somewhere.
Drunk.
They're all drunk, and he just starts making up this song as they
You're
go.
A mean one.
Because as Mr. brilliant as it is, on the scale of great songs, it is one of the ones you could most believe was written in like a half hour.
Oh yeah, it's got that drunken music hall energy. It's fantastic, absolutely. But I do agree with you.
I feel like that's an opportunity for us to work that in there as well. And they just improvise it, right? And that could be another song. Like, that's where they get the name Grinch from the story, right? Mm-hmm. And like, the old vet who was bedridden from the diner shares the story and the name with Cindy Lou Who. And Max will recognize the song because, not knowing what it's really about, he has also heard that song because those old army guys used to sing it every Christmas.
Mm-hmm. It's this, generational holiday trauma, generational military trauma. Mm-hmm. I love this. I would also, another thing that I regret not having more time and space for is dialogue from the Grinch. And all of this extra lore really lends itself to him having kind of like a villain monologue, like an explaining himself monologue, which of course could be something along the lines of, they sang without mercy. They sang without feeling. They sang through injections and chemical peeling. Doug Jones is good on the mic. Doug Jones gets to talk in this one, you guys.
He's great. You know, five seasons of Star Trek Discovery.
A third act reveal that the Grinch speaks in verse would really go hard. Because up until that point, it's just been like monosyllabic or like single words or like good dog. But then when he has his speech,
I think it's an all or nothing thing. I think that if you dip in and out of it, it starts to feel a little cheaty or half measure, like you were talking about with the previous live action Grinch movie, the other real live action Grinch movie. But I do think it has to be something about the strange dimension that he comes from, you know, maybe it's a bit of like an Etrigan quality.
Is he speaking in rhyme and meter? Like, I guess that's how they do it in his universe.
And it makes it more poetic, which is extremely Universal Monsters.
I also think there's a one thing that our new like scientific wrinkle adds is, okay, so we do the reveal of thing one and thing two, you know, maybe that's our end of movie, that's our mid-credit scene. But then we have a post-credit scene set on December 25th, 1 year later. And you know, during our movie, Cindy Lou has found like the machine they used to open the rift or whatever, you know, like the platform, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
Now it's a year later and the room is empty. Nobody's around. You know, Cindy, it's abandoned once again, but the rift starts crackling to life because it's December 25th and some green fingers poke through.
No.
And it cuts to black.
Not green fingers.
Okay.
Like a weird red and white stripe.
Oh,
like
no.
Appendage is poking through
a cat's paw,
like or a cat's paw, but lower, like or just the hat.
I think
bursts out of it and lands limply.
I think it's got to be the hat.
You got to be the cat in the hat.
Starts peeking through.
Oh my god!
That's where they're
this
from.
This time it'll be someone who has come over on purpose, looking for the Grinch.
Yeah,
and discovers what's happened to the Grinch. And then seeks revenge with the help of Thing One and Thing Two.
And Cindy Lou, of course, will need to partner with a good entity from this universe who can kind of guide her, named the Lorax.
Absolutely.
And then the Dark Seussiverse is off to a roaring start.
Oh, my dream.
The Dark Seussiverse. Oh, my God. Okay. We might have to revisit this.
We're so back. We're so back.
I wish I had spent more time learning to illustrate or something. So, Daniel, we could just team up and do a little indie comic of, I guess there's a lot of copyright issues here.
This would be, I think, pretty sticky to do. But
yeah.
If they got away with it with the Mean One, who knows?
I'm very surprised on the Mean One. My understanding is that this is an estate that is like sort of infamously litigious. And, you know, rightfully so.
Especially with like sort of things for children, you got to be more protective than for your average book or comic.
Yeah. And, there's the movie rights changing hands all the time. And there's the ones that have like racist caricatures kind of being... filtered out. Like it's very much it's a going concern. There's a lot of preciousness around the Seuss brand is pretty high stakes these days. So let's roll the dice.
Apparently, I'm also seeing here that after the disastrous release of the Mike Myers Cat in the Hat film.
Oh, is that how they see that? Disastrous.
didn't it make like $1 billion?
Did it? Look, I'm editorializing. Mae I don't understand.
That movie making an ungodly amount of money.
In my mind, the narrative is that like it's a hit, but it's like really off-putting, and then it was kind of like an infamous kind of like Razzie movie.
Yeah.
And now there's a sort of like weird quasi reevaluation of it from like a design perspective.
I will say that after seeing the live action Grinch, I will never watch that film. But I will. Look, I'm just going to read what I said. What I just saw on Wikipedia on the day of the film's release, Mike Myers said, I guess a sequel called The Cat in the Hat Comes Back was in development just a month after the film came out. But following the film's poor reception, Seuss's widow halted any future live action adaptations of Seuss's works, including the planned sequel. So apparently the widow has said no more live action Seuss.
I misremember this being a big hit.
It
made $133.9 on a $109 million budget, which after marketing would not be considered.
Yeah, that's not great. Yeah, that's not good.
That's not great. But we do now have the upcoming Bill Hader Cat in the Hat.
And you know what? That trailer looked like fun.
It looked fun. It looked fun.
It looks funny. He's naturally very funny. I can't imagine. Like my theory on all of this stuff right now is that we're so in the era of IP, and for people who do not live in Los Angeles, you may not know this, but like the jobs are kind of scarce. So what happens is a lot of talented people end up doing things like a Cat in the Hat movie, and the sort of the baseline quality of everything kind of goes up. And, you know, maybe there's like a cringy joke or a cringy needle drop or something that, you know, is the mandate of a studio or a focus group. But largely the movies don't, you know, the Super Mario Brothers movie feels like a cousin of the Grinch movie the Jim Carrey Grinch movie is this thing that's like really just kind of the IP and name only and like fueled by cocaine and like how do we figure it out? How do we, you know, who even cares if we use the game? And I think that the Jim Carrey Grinch is, you know, this a bit of a bridge where people my age are like, you added a lot of weird stuff. And then you watch the animated Grinch and it's pretty uncontroversial. You know, maybe it's not your favorite movie, but you would never say that this is like, you know, like a laughably bad failure. It just might not be something that resonates with you.
Yeah, I think, you know, we kind of rightfully have a very knee-jerk reaction to these things these days. You know, I think especially with, you see like all the, I mean, we're talking about this in the middle of this like Warner Brothers, Netflix, Paramount, just like no good options, like kind of fiasco. And so it's easy to look at all of this stuff and just have this like distaste for any IP corporate, you know, kind of stuff. But I think you're right that like and I don't begrudge anyone that. Anyone who says, fuck that, I'm not seeing a new Cat in the Hat movie in 2026. Yeah, good. I don't care. Like,
yeah,
do your thing.
That's very understandable.
Seeing the trailer, seeing the trailer for 2026 Cat in the Hat after watching the 2000 Grinch, I'm like, yeah, I'd much rather have this. Like, I like, I like in the trailer that like there's different animation styles for when you're in the Cat in the Hat's world versus when he's in the real world. Mm-hmm. Like, that's cute. I think that's a cool decision. Does it need to exist? Absolutely not.
Right.
But definitely probably not.
Those are the only jobs that you can get, if you can get the green light to do something interesting, to do something different, which became so much easier to do, I gather, since Spider-Verse.
Yeah, that's sort of the one we're circling.
Gamble,
yeah.
Right?
And then Spider-Verse and Lego Movie right before it.
Right.
And then I would also throw Barbie in there as this sort of like, we're looking at this stuff differently. The money people are looking at this stuff differently. The artists are looking at this stuff differently. Is it plan A? Maybe not.
Yeah.
But do I think that, like, if I was offered, you know, the sneeches, I would work very hard on it. And I would try to have it, you know, have a lot of, like, integrity and good jokes in
it. And this is why we believe that Vera Drew's Echo the Dolphin will happen.
Will happen.
Oh, believe that movie Echo the Dolphin will be
we
real.
We deserve that.
Yes.
Also, can we just shout out, we posted a clip from that episode about that Vera Drew's desire to make an Echo the Dolphin movie, and the internet spoke the fuck up.
Yes.
That is the most action we have ever gotten on Blue Sky.
The internet wants Vera Drew's Echo the Dolphin.
Yeah, so
they brought
talking
back
about
change.org.
Keep that going. Yes. Start that petition.
And let's get one going for Daniel Kibble-Smith's Star-Bellied Sneetches.
Yeah, man. It's an important lesson. We're all brothers on this world.
I would love to adapt the Butter Battle book. I have
that one's grim. Yeah, that's a good one.
That's one I want to do. And like that's the one where you heard like there were like people who were like, oh, we're gonna do Oliver Stone's Monopoly, that kind of thing. Like, no, that's what I want. I want Alfonso Cuarón to make an adaptation of the Butter Battle book.
That's the move. That's
if he's not into it, I'll do it. You know,
the Seuss Widow's coming back to say that we're doing live action again,
and I'll be doing Hop on Pop.
I remembered Butter Battle book. I'm just confirming on Wikipedia that it's a later Seuss, and it's 1984. It's not peak Cold War, but it's kind of peak, you know, Reagan Iron Curtain kind of. It's just so explicitly about nuclear war. It's so explicitly about mutually assured destruction.
I was in second grade when I read that book, and I don't even know if I ever read it again, but I remember it so well.
It's
granted,
it's
my brain at this point was already primed by classic Star Trek to read like political allegory stuff.
Yeah.
But like,
they weren't crazy about nuclear war either, I don't think.
On that show, not much.
It wasn't their destination, their preferred destination.
Yeah, I grew up at that point in my life. I had, for a six-year-old, seen an uncommon amount of classic Trek and classic Twilight Zone, and every third episode is about maybe don't do nuclear war.
Yeah, we gotta knock it off, fellas. And you know, obviously today it'd be probably an analog for the Chinese AI singularity versus our AI singularity. But that's what makes it a timeless classic, son.
Yeah.
The Chinese are going to invent smell-o-vision before AI.
That's right.
I am calling that in 2026. Do you guys know about You're Only Old Once?
No.
So this
I've read that. Yeah.
I just learned about this. So this was a Dr. Seuss book he released on his 82nd birthday. And it's a classic kind of Dr. Seuss book, but it's for adults. And he was spending a lot of time in hospitals because he's old and having a lot of illnesses. Mm-hmm. And so he started, while he was in the hospital, sketching all the machines and stuff. And so he wrote a book in verse, just like a children's verse, but for adults about getting old.
Wow.
And I got it from my parents for Christmas this year. Yeah, I hope they don't take it the wrong way, but I just think it's really beautiful and like funny. And it was his first book for adults in 47 years. I had no idea about it. But
that sounds really interesting.
I have the copy upstairs if you want to read it in 15 minutes before you leave.
Yeah, maybe so on my way out the door, you know?
I think the market has changed a lot, but my kid has some Dr. Seuss books. It's not, you know, as proportionately like looming large as it was for my generation. But I think like incredible writer and artist and underrated from a cartooning perspective is what I always bring up. Because they are obviously children's book illustrations, but he was also a cartoonist.
Yeah.
And the way he you know, what he brought to both of those sort of overlapping spaces is pretty remarkable.
And you're saying that you think your Grinch absolutely does all of his work justice.
Better, probably. Yeah.
Yeah, better. Really, it doesn't just carry on his legacy, it elevates his legacy.
Yeah, I think between the three of us, we really fixed some stuff.
Yeah. Well, Daniel, this was an incredible pitch. I think we've really got a winner here. I think the Dark Seussiverse, I wish we had come up with this before we started the pod universe.
Right, because this could be a whole arm that we could just put you in charge of, the way that James Gunn was supposed to do Marvel Cosmic in the MCU.
Oh, yeah.
This could have just been your whole wing of our universe.
I think we can still make that happen, you know?
If you want to come back next season,
yeah, you sure?
We would love to hear what you're doing next.
Hey, if there's anything I love, it's a December tradition. So...
So next year we will have Daniel Smith Kibblesmith coming back to do How the Grinch Stole Christmas 2:Christmas, which has the Cat in the Hat coming through the portal.
Well, let's not pigeonhole Daniel. You can come in next Christmas and pitch whatever
you want. I've got a year to come up with something truly insane.
But we would love if we made the Dark Seussiverse a Christmas tradition here. That could be cool. If you feel that way, hey, hit us a comment on YouTube or Spotify. Yes. Hit us up on social media at the Pod Universe, wherever we are on social media.
Yes.
And that's exciting. It makes a great segue to Daniel Kibblesmith. Where can people find your work and your social media presence? And what do you want to talk about?
Sure. I really appreciated the intro. I'm very excited about the adult animated comedy Strip Law coming out in February. It's created and run by my friend and frequent collaborator, Cullen Crawford, one of the funniest people in the world. You might know him from the tweet about killing E.T. with hammers. That is like,
oh, yes.
It's like weirdly like this thing that won't die. But in addition to that, he's probably the funniest person I know. And I truly believe that when Strip Law drops, if you love things that, you know, we were influenced by in the room, like the whatever your favorite season of Simpsons is, or Detroiters, or just, you know, comedy. That's what this show is delivering. It's about lawyers in Vegas, and it's funny and it's gross and it's unapologetically comedy. So really hope everybody checks that out. Oh, and when you do, this is true. When you do check it out, when you're done watching it, click the double thumbs up on Netflix. Netflix really likes the double thumbs up. If you click single thumbs up, believe it or not, that's bad. So either
really?
because Netflix is a computer company, and they have their own rules that I am learning. So you can do nothing, or you can click the double thumbs up, but do not touch the single thumbs up.
All right, the single thumbs up get dumped in the field like the tubes in Lost, you know, with the turtles.
I have no idea.
Yeah.
Here's
the
thing. I have no idea.
I've never hit any of those buttons once, and that means it's my fault Sense8 got canceled.
Yeah, correct. That is your fault.
Correct.
Yeah, and now we're never going to get the Wachowskis on the show. Yeah. Thanks, Dylan. By the way,
I really liked Sense8.
We can cut this if I'm wrong, but am I crazy or... Is Branson?
Branson's also working on that show.
Branson's on the show. Yep.
Oh, yeah. Yep. We should bring that up. Previous guest Branson Reese, who did
also on the writing staff
Ghostbusters,
of that show.
Also on the staff of Strip Law.
Branson
is
on the voice acting staff of the show as well.
Oh, hell yeah!
Yeah.
Awesome.
So I cannot recommend this more highly to the podheads.
Yeah, if you're a fan of this show, you are absolutely going to love Strip Law. I mean, I'm very excited for it.
It's the first time I ever set a reminder through Netflix to watch anything. I've never used that feature before.
Hey, that's probably good, too.
Yeah, well, that's right. Great.
Because you and Branson asked me to.
So. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's up there. It's up there. Yeah, you may have seen me doing it on Blue Sky. You can also set a reminder for it, which is more sweet data for the data company.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah. I wish more people knew about this. Like, I only know, first of all, the double thumbs up thing now because you're telling me directly, and I only knew how important the reminder thing is to the people who finance these shows when you and or Branson explained it on Blue Sky.
It's crazy. It's like giving your electrician 5 stars. Just do it. You know, they'll get fired. Yeah. Strip Law's coming out in February.
Everybody go through your Netflix history right now and double thumbs up all the things that you like.
Anything you love, bring back Inside Job. Just go.
Yeah, double thumbs up, Strip Law, and yeah, anything else?
The new book is So You've Been Bitten by a Radioactive Spider, How to Survive the Marvel Universe from Chronicle Books, which is a very funny hardcover handbook about how to survive the Marvel Universe if you've been deposited there. It teaches you how to handle your new superpowers, how to handle being the only person not on the team or on the team without superpowers. There's a table where you get to roll a 20-sided die to figure out your superhero name. We teach you how to speak Groot. We give you a lot of real world advice about like how do you climb a wall, how do you lift Thor's hammer without straining yourself. So if you liked the worst case scenario guide, because it did have all this like technically real but very implausible advice, we've written one for the Marvel Universe. And if you're buying gifts, I was surprised but not shocked to find out it is very popular with children. With kids about 7 to 12, because they really love, behind the scenes and lore and manuals and stuff. So if you're trying to get a kid into the Marvel Universe, this is sort of an interactive atlas and almanac of the Marvel Universe. And it reminded me that I loved, like, whenever they would do a cross section of the Baxter building and show you how the Fantastic Four.
Those like DK or whatever books where you get Star Wars, or Star Trek ships. Yep. This feels like a Freddy's head would be really into this as well.
Kids like superheroes, I'm learning. That is something interesting.
I'm expecting that to be burned out at some point, the way that we don't care about cowboys. But so far, I mean, I live in Queens. Spider-Man everything all the time.
Yeah, now, hometown hero.
Is there a section for people who don't have superpowers that just says, do not live in New York City in all caps, underlined?
Is there a real estate guide to like disaster probability the way you have like flood maps?
That's sort of the whole book, honestly. It's really like, it's less of a one-liner and more of like a tonal approach. So if you're like a damage control fan, like this is a very damage control kind of book.
That is one of my favorite premises in Marvel Comics.
I frequently think about how like in the Marvel New York City, like, would it be most affordable to live in Midtown? And all the billionaires live like way out in Brooklyn and Queens.
Right. The Hamptons is like, even more expensive.
Yeah. Like the artists and the people who like can't afford any kind of rent are living on 42nd Street on Broadway because, you know, you live there and your apartment's going to get destroyed.
These are questions I have always really wanted to explore for 10 years. I have been occasionally jotting down notes for a rock opera in the style of the Hold Steady called In the Shadow of the Baxter Building. And it is about two kids from Jersey who are about to graduate high school, taking the train into New York for a party, but it's Marvel's New York. And so, like, there's a bunch of stuff. I think it's a trio of kids because there's three main characters in most Hold Steady albums. So we sort of have our equivalent of Charlemagne and Hallelujah and Gideon. And the one who's the Charlemagne, sorry, the one who's the equivalent. This is not great radio, what I'm doing right here. If you love the Hold Steady, let us know in the chat. Anyway, the point is that we beat one person's a mutant and her friends don't know yet. And so this becomes like a story about all of them getting through, like a coming of age story told in the form of something like Craig Finn spinning a yarn Kerouac style over some rock music. But I've written like two songs worth of lyrics about like this story. And I started it like long before we met and I will never finish it. If you really want to hear In the Shadow of the Baxter Building, please comment below.
But and for now,
I do. You just you sold a bitch to me.
For now, you can read the very real book by Daniel Kibblesmith while you wait for the Dylan Roth rock opera.
Yes, yes. To be clear, one of these is a product you can buy and enjoy right now, and the other thing is even more imaginary than the imaginary shit we usually talk about on the show, and that I will probably never write it.
A new layer of hypothetical.
Yes. It's fake pitches all the way down. Anything else, Daniel? I know you are so you've always got so many irons on the fire.
Yes. I would love to have fewer. I'm working. I'd love to have one big iron. I'm kibblesmith.com on Blue Sky, but like I also just like block a lot of people, so I don't know if we'll have a good time. I'm Daniel.kibblesmith on Instagram, but like that's meta, so that's bad. So I do update my website, which is kibblesmith.com. And if you go to your local comic book store, and you may have to ask for them specifically, but I have Rick and Morty comics coming out right now, and I have Darkwing Duck comics coming out
Hell
right now.
Hell yeah. Thank you once again for coming on and pitching us a lovely holiday tale.
Yeah, Daniel, this was a treat, man.
An absolute pleasure.
Did not disappoint at all. Yeah, we're going to let Daniel go, and we're going to take care of some, we're going to take care of a little bit of a pod business for y'all right after this message. Daniel?
Thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much.
Stink, stank, stunk.
This episode is brought to you by Spooky Aura and their new RPG zine, White City. Spooky Aura's White City is about occult investigators patrolling the 1893 Chicago World's Fair for supernatural threats. This game is designed for busy adults who don't have the time for a long campaign. It's great for pick up and play groups and bars that host one-session RPG games. A table can build characters, grab a mission card, and start a game in minutes. Fast character creation, a simple 2d6 resolution mechanic, and a driving question to give players a specific problem to investigate and solve in about 3 hours. This RPG zine has 10, you count them, 10 supernatural adventures that could have happened. Meet T.S. Eliot, Annie Oakley, or Scott Joplin at the World's Fair. Look for the Pusher, the Cool Woman, or try to capture the Hat Man before the sun rises. White City is a dynamic, engaging role-playing game designed for busy people. Check it out and play when you can. You can find it and a bunch of other RPG zines at retrofitgamescompany.itch.io. And we are back. This reminds me, Dalton.
Yes.
Since our last recording, I actually participated in a RPG.
That's right.
An RPG thing with our friends at Plus One EXP.
Yeah.
I played a round of Ritual Deck.
Yeah.
Two 3 hour sessions. Was really fun. And I think that in addition to having a clip from that in the next bonus ep, I think that the full edited version will be up on Plus One EXP on their YouTube channel for people to watch by now.
Incredible.
Which
so,
is exciting
first-hand
stuff.
Experience.
Yes.
With the product.
I really liked doing that.
Hell yeah.
If you are somebody who has an actual play type show and you're looking for performers, I think I've caught the bug. So let me know. And if scheduling permitting, I would love to participate.
Thank you again to Daniel. That was an incredible pitch. Sorry again for us being off last week.
Yeah, we just had a little
holiday
scheduling snag. I think this is the first time that we've had like an unscheduled break in a while. Our track record, I think, is pretty strong for a podcast about not missing weeks.
Yeah, let's talk about what our schedule is going to look like, first of all, for the rest of the year, and then also in the new year.
Indeed. Yeah.
So
next week is our final episode of the year on the main feed.
Yes.
Final episode of the Pod Universe next week, and then we will be coming back. Right now, I have a schedule to return on January 18th.
Yeah. TBD.
That one, can we announce the...
Oh, that one we've already taped.
We've already taped that one.
Let's
That's going to be an episode we've already recorded. It'll take a little time to produce, but we'll have plenty of time to do it. We have video game and D&D YouTuber Tulok the Barbarian, who came here to pitch a Dark Universe take on the Pied Piper. And Tulok came fucking prepared. Tulok, who, by the way, traveled on two trains and a bus to record here in the studio so that we could do a full scripted episode.
Tulak, who's from Wisconsin, right? Or Minnesota.
Was in town in Philly for PAX.
Was in Philly for PAX.
And then traveled here. This was a full day affair. We recorded a full scripted episode. I do think I have to do a score for it because I think to do it justice.
I do want to emphasize he wrote a full score, the style that we do for our canon episodes.
Yes. This is essentially a full-on episode of Are You Afraid of the Dark Universe that we're going to kick off with next time.
Not only that, he wrote a trailer that will have a video component that plays before the movie.
Yes.
And then the full script, which will be scored. It's going to be a big, exciting one. Tulak went mad
on this. So we're very excited. I think we're planning on recording something for his channel at some point early next year, which might also be an actual play.
We're getting a little out of order. So that's going to come in the new year. But first of all, next week is going to be our first holiday special. And I say that in quotes because
this was sort of the holiday themed holiday special.
Yes, we have decided to do a new thing annually in our holiday spot that is perhaps the most high concept bit we have ever come up with. And this is the last time I will refer to it out of kayfabe. Next week, you're in for a wild ride.
Yeah, we're going to be recording it right after this. And from what I know, from my portion creatively of it, it's fucking wild. And you have talked, you've been very enthusiastic about the part that you've written for it.
It's been very, very fun to write. We will not tell you literally anything about
it. Yeah, you'll find out. We will probably obscure it even in the title of the episode.
You will not get
the whole story about it until you click through.
Yeah, so come back next week for what promises to be the stupidest and craziest episode of the show yet. Then the week after that, we will have a bonus pod ep where we wrap up our sort of year-end media that we haven't otherwise covered on the show.
Our faves and farts, as I've been calling it, for 2025. And then that will be our last episode for a couple of weeks. We're going to take a little bit of time to enjoy the holidays with our families and then to produce that episode with Tulak. And then we will get to Merge Conflict, which is my next solo script for the pod universe.
Now, another thing to talk about with next year, our schedule is going to be changing very, very slightly. You see, the wives came to us.
Yes, independently, but with a common agenda of trying to make sure we don't stroke out before we turn 40. We will be adding a buffer week to the rotation of our schedule so that we're not working so much.
Yes, they approached us with some concerns. Essentially, once we started the pod universe, we really tried to give you content every week. It was, you know, the two-part pitch episodes, a bonus pod, a guest ep. Repeat. It's going to be that same 4-week cycle with an extra off week built in. And I don't think we've figured out exactly where that's going.
I think the current, I do have a draft of this schedule worked up. I believe the plan is going to be that we will do a guest episode and then the scripted episodes and then the week off. I think.
We'll figure that out for sure. But we're
going to
be on a 5-week cycle, essentially. Yes. And you are going to get content 4 out of those 5 weeks.
If you are a Patreon subscriber, you'll get 4 out of those 5 weeks. And if you are not, you will still get it 3
of
out of those 5 weeks.
Yeah.
And we will try, whenever possible, never to give the main feed 2 consecutive weeks with nothing.
Yes.
We don't want to keep you all waiting. It is not like we've been pretty bullish. Like, you know, we grind pretty hard over here. Despite our avowed hatred for capitalism and grindset culture or whatever, we are workaholics and also just desperate to make it. So, but
to please
it is a matter of our loved ones looking after our health. So we hope that you will hope you'll indulge us and be kind about our week off.
So let's thank our patrons.
Yes.
We're still making this all possible.
On that note, we'd like to thank our executive producers. These are our patrons who contribute $15 every month to our show to help make this possible and buy themselves a little shout out on the air for every episode we record during that time. Thank you to Brent Dreyer, Brian Egan, Denim Mudslide, Diana, Jonathan Morgantini, Caleb McFarland, Matt Thackray, Michael Mancillis, Mike Lee Whiplash, Soonmott, and Speep. We really appreciate your contribution to our show. And a big thanks to our studio executives. These are patrons who contribute $25 a month to our show. In addition to a shout out, they get to pick one of the studio mandates that we talk about and do a rough pitch for on the bonus pod. Thank you so much to Alyssa, the Pazuzu apologist, Bill French, Beerus, Brandon Bullock, Dracatella, Jasper Stark, Joe Valiant, Cadel, Moose, Rich Mays, The Wayfinder, and Weiss Belladonna. We really appreciate your support of our show.
Great. So we are going to go and record our holiday special next.
And as for sign-off, I did write down...
Do we have a new one?
I wrote down one that came from Social Justice Rogue. I think this I think you should do
this
one.
Good one.
This feels like a like you should price it up on this one.
This one might be a little long to stick around forever, but
no,
I will price it up.
The idea now is I think that we should do a different one every week.
Okay. Well,
the pod universe is now leaving your ears, but not your mind. You've been infected, and you will be back.
See you next week.
Bye, everybody.